the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
Indeed, and I'm John Leffler. Our guest this week is Dr. Gary Small from the UCLA Center for Longevity. You might guess what it is he's going to be talking about here on the program. Why, it's longevity. All right, look, here we are into the second quarter of the year. You have just filed your income taxes. You did do that, right? I mean, you knew you were supposed to do that. Okay, good. We're long past any kind of New Year's resolutions. How are you doing on those resolutions? Yeah, it usually lasts until about the 5th of January, if you noticed that. And if you got some unwelcome surprise taxes, now the question is here, what are you going to do about it? Now's the time for tax planning for the next time you have to file taxes. You still have 8.5 months to do something about it. And today's show is a warning about something we all love to do, and that's procrastination. There are major changes that are coming to the financial markets. One is due to global financial repression, which we talked about on last Saturday's Financial Sense News Hour. And if you didn't hear that, you should. There's going to be the full brunt of the Obamacare taxes and fines and penalties after 2016. The coming Fed rate hikes, although Jim, I'll believe this when I see it, given all of the promises as we're going.
We've heard about that since 2010, I think.
Yeah.
I think they're serious this time. We just don't know when.
That's true. This time it's different, right? Okay. And all of this, one way or another, is going to impact you and me. Now the question is, are you just going to sit there, or what are you going to do about it? You're going to wait until you see a black swan event in your own particular portfolio, or do you have a road map and a backup plan for your life and retirement planning?
You know something, John, I want to start this out and use several analogies here because I really want to demonstrate a point here. I want to begin with, let's take our automobile. Now, we all know to keep a car running well, you got to take it in for periodic tune-ups. You know, you got to change the oil, and gosh, with modern cars today, it tells you when you need to do that. It says, hey, get the car in for service, and you know what happens if you don't. The car starts to break down. So we're very familiar with routine maintenance tune-ups to keep the car running smoothly. And if we do that, the car functions and it lasts longer. Ignore this and you've got engine problems. The same thing could be used and apply it towards your health. Because we know the importance of annual physical exams, you want to catch problems early, and if possible, take corrective action to improve your health and wellness. Well, the same thing that applies in car and health also applies to our finances. We need to monitor them. Are we on track for our financial goals? Are you tired of paying higher taxes after you just filed them? Well, you need to have a plan to reduce them. You want to retire and remain retired? Well, you need to have a plan to help get you there and keep you there. And you don't want to wake up one day with life changing. Events such as one spouse loses a job. Think about what happened after the financial crisis of 2008. Or you wake up one day and all of a sudden you find the unexpected loved one you're ending up taking care of, either an aging parent, it could be a grandchild, or maybe an unexpected illness. And let's not forget about those unexpected events or black swans that occasionally happen in the stock market, sometimes rather serious ones like 2007 and 2009.
Those we call non-linearities. You know, what's interesting, Jim, is what I call the non-linearity, which is the same as a black swan or rogue event. They really do change everything. What changed it for my mother and me was the fact that our family home in California burned down in 2003, and that completely upended everything in what we were doing, and we wound up finally providing care for my mother for almost 5 years. It happened suddenly and without warning. You're having a similar issue with your mom.
Yeah. The other issue, too, is, you know, I lost my father at an early age, and unfortunately, that was back in the days where, you know, the only thing he had was Social Security, didn't have much of a pension. So, you know, all of a sudden, these kind of events happen. I've seen clients raising grandchildren. I had a client back in the 90s whose daughter died of a drug overdose, and he ended up becoming a parent to children that were in grade school at that time, raising them once again through high school and into college, or clients taking care of an elderly parent. And let's not forget those unexpected events like 2000 and 2008. Remember in 2000 when we were in the new economy? Well, it turned out to be not so new after all. And of course, 2008. 2008, John, I think more than anything, has changed the retirement outcomes for so many individuals, either one planning for a retirement or those that were retired are finding they didn't have the lifestyle they thought they were going to have as a result of something we talked about last weekend, which was financial repression and 0% interest rates. That really altered the retirement plans of many individuals, and also the retirement plans for those thinking of retiring. Many of those plans have been postponed.
You know, I think what we're trying to say here is the need for a plan to deal with life's unexpected, contingencies? And I mean, life is going to throw these at you. And if you have some framework from which to operate, you can usually change and chuck and jive a bit to deal with the things that life tends to throw at you. You know, we know that the Fed is going to be raising interest rates, and that means that there's a change ahead in the markets. We know that there is a dramatic change in healthcare coming after 2016. After all, we have to look at this plan to see what's in it, according to Nancy Pelosi. The tech bubble burst. These were some of the things that we've happened. Look at the last 15 years. The tech bubble burst. We had 9/11. We had the 2007-08 financial crisis. There was the bursting real estate bubble. And now, negative rate and 0% interest rates. How many of our listeners have seen, as a result of all these things, a change in their retirement or their retirement plans?
You know, one issue too that is also coming up that we often talk about here in the program is one of the bedrocks of retirement planning is Social Security. However, the deficit, John, for the first time, is now starting to go up again, and it probably will start to go up again as more and more boomers retire, putting more strains on Social Security and Medicare. And for the first time, and this really surprised me, is a Republican candidate, Governor Chris Christie, talked about limiting Social Security for people making $80,000 or more and phasing it out completely for individuals making $200,000 and more. And we know that there's been a lot of talk coming from the Democratic camp talking about phasing out Social Security for those who paid in the most, really high income earners. So you've got both Republicans talking about this and Democrats, and the government is going to be forced one way or another to deal with this as we get closer to the end of this decade, is more and more, I think it's what, to the tune of 10,000 baby boomers retiring on almost a daily basis. So a change is in the air, not only in the markets, but also in taxes and even entitlements.
You know, and even though the show is all about the dangers of procrastination, there is a positive message in the whole thing. You can alter the outcome of your future and make yourself less susceptible to the winds of change, but you do need to have a roadmap and a backup plan so when life throws you something, especially a curveball, you're not caught off guard. Or if it surprises you, you can have a quick react and regroup and then deal with the whole thing. So, Jim, this week we had in the United States the deadline for filing of income tax on April 15th. We still have 8.5 months left to do something about this. The tax laws are changing. As you said, there will be other consequences by 2016. What should our listeners be doing, especially in terms of their retirement planning?
Well, I mean, last week we did a whole show on some various strategies used to reduce your taxes. And probably the most positive one to reduce your taxes is called reducing deductions on the top line. And that's really the first page of your tax return. And the most effective way to do that, as we talked about on the show last week, was tax-favored investments, whether it's tax-free bonds, tax-favored investments like stocks, dividends, which are taxed at lower rates along with capital gains, tax deferral, such as annuities, or a tax-sheltered investment, things like master limited partnerships, royalty trusts, which can shelter part of the dividend, and tax pension plans, everything from pensions, your 401k, 403b plan, or SEP IRAs. probably the most effective way to reduce your taxes, because it also keeps you out of those various Obama brackets of $250,000, $300,000, and $450,000 if you're married, $200,000, $300,000, and $400,000 if you are a single individual. But you just paid your taxes. If you want to do something about it, you got 8.5 months. Now's the time to be thinking about this, not when it comes to December.
Well, this is what wealthy people do. They use accountants and various other experts to reduce their taxes, and it's legitimate to do it. It's legitimate to avoid taxes, not evade them. Evade them is illegal. So you owe it to yourself, and it's legitimate to do it, not to pay more taxes than you have to. The politicians who make these laws shelter their own income. So they know where these little loopholes are being put in. And you always are hearing stories about well-known politicians avoiding paying tax.
You know, the best example I can probably give you, John, when it comes to not paying taxes is, you know, everybody knows Warren Buffett. Now, just to give you an example, Warren Buffett, in the latest returns that we have for Buffett, he doesn't disclose what he pays in taxes. But for some reason, in 2010, that was released. In 2010, Warren Buffett made roughly about $40 million. He paid $6.9 million in income taxes. Buffett's tax rate was 17.3%. Now, everybody knows Warren Buffett as being a great investor, but I tell you, he's not only a great investor, but he's a genius at avoiding paying taxes. Buffett owns 20% of Berkshire Hathaway, a $250 billion market cap company, which gives Warren his net worth of close to $72 billion, making him the second richest man in the world. Unlike corporations in the S&P, the average company in the S&P 500 pays out about 30% of their earnings in dividends. Guess what, John? How much do you think Berkshire pays in dividends?
I guess I'd be safe if I said what? Nothing?
You guessed it. Why? Because Warren Buffett is the largest shareholder in Berkshire Hathaway. If Berkshire Hathaway paid out 30% of its earnings and cash flow in the way of dividends, Warren Buffett, who owns 20% of the company, would have an annual income of $1.2 billion, taxed at a favorable rate, by the way, of about 23.8%. Warren Buffett would be paying $280 million in taxes instead of his $7 million in taxes. And you see this, John, when Buffett takes over a company, I don't care if it's Heinz or the recent takeover of Kraft, one of the first things that Buffett does is he eliminates the dividends. And that's why, because he understands the tax favorability of stocks or dividends versus bonds. And it's why Buffett has gotten to be as wealthy as he has, because he understands the compounding of corporate earnings and cash flow. And that's what made Buffett a very rich man, but he also understands the tax implications. Think how much, if you're listening to this program, how much more wealth, how much more savings, how much more you would have at your disposal if you could pay only 17% in taxes. Heck, if you're self-employed, Social Security alone is 15.6%. So you can see there, it's one of the reasons why Warren Buffett is one of the richest men in the world. It's not just stock prowess, it's his genius at avoiding paying taxes.
You know, I thought there were certain tax provisions against accumulated earnings that you can't do that, and at some point, you're going to have to pay taxes on that.
Well, you're probably referring to something called IRS Section 531, and basically, this was put into place by the Internal Revenue Service for individuals. They have their own corporations that don't distribute dividends for that very reason, because you pay tax on your earnings. Then if you distribute those earnings in the form of dividends, you pay another tax, which is why Buffett doesn't do it with Berkshire Hathaway, because if he did, Buffett would be paying close to $300 million a year in taxes instead of the $6 or $7 million that he does. And the IRS could probably go after Buffett under this rule. But let's put it this way. When you're that wealthy, you employ lobbyists. You're connected politically, especially to the White House. But, you know, listeners can do the same thing themselves. You need the same principle when you're investing personally of tax-favored and tax-deferred investments, because they're taxed at a lower rate of taxation, which is why Buffett prefers equity investments, because he knows he's going to pay a lower rate of tax.
Now, last week we talked about above-the-line deductions. What about below-the-line deductions? Which do you recommend when you look at the two? And of course, we're looking here at your total adjusted gross income is what that line is.
You know, John, I prefer above-the-line deductions versus below-the-line deductions, which are your itemized deductions. There's a couple of reasons why. Obama came in and reduced the impact of those deductions by taking 3% of your adjusted gross income once you reach a certain level, and they subtract that from your itemized deductions. And over the years, they've eliminated, for example, the sales tax deduction. They limited, to some extent, medical expense deductions and miscellaneous deductions. And there's more and more talk about tax reform. One of the things that Congress is talking about is removing itemized deductions in exchange for lower taxes. And then what will happen is once they get rid of the deductions, then they come back and they raise the tax rates. That's what they did with Reagan tax reform when they lowered tax rates to 28% for getting rid of all the tax shelters. They got rid of the tax shelters up front. Eventually, over a three-year period, they lowered tax rates to 28%. The following year, George Bush Sr. raised taxes, and 4 years later, Bill Clinton raised them.
Well, there's the lesson learned on that. You have to have a plan to minimize your taxes, and that way you get to keep more of your income. And of course, that means you have more to invest to provide for more income in the future. And you have to do this in an era of low or 0% interest rates. But if you do this properly, you'll have greater security and you will have more wealth to provide for yourself. Now, what I want to do here is move on to another risk, and that is the danger of the Fed raising interest rates. We know this has been the big topic of conversation. And one thing we do know historically is that the bear markets that we have experienced in the past are Fed induced. So with the Fed on a path to raise interest rates, they keep hinting at it and taking certain words out of their definitions. Somewhere out there at some time, there's going to be another recession or bear market. There's another risk lurking. So what do investors do to try to make money while at the same time anticipating this change?
I mean, we're always going to have bear markets, and despite politicians or central bankers saying that, you know, we've tamed the business cycle or we've tamed market cycles. Remember that, John, around the turn of the century when we were supposed to be in the new, quote, era economy, we found that not to be true. But, you know, that's the way markets work. We have bull markets, we have bear markets. There's nothing to fear if you have a plan. And one of the examples I always like to give is going back to 2008, because that was probably one of the worst years that we've seen in the financial market since the Great Depression. And I gave an example that actually applied from a case study where a client had 50% of their assets in fixed income bonds. It was a laddered bond portfolio, 40% in stocks, and roughly about 10% in cash. Now, if we fast forward, when we got to the bottom of the market, which was March of 2009, the stock portfolio was down about 30%. So on $1 million portfolio, stocks were down roughly about $120,000. But on the converse side, because of the bonds with interest rates coming down, the bond portfolio was up 10%. The net effect of all of that was in the worst bear market that we've probably seen since 1973-74, or the Great Depression, the overall portfolio was down 7%. But here's the important thing. Income didn't change during that financial crisis. The laddered bond portfolio never changed their interest rates. They didn't go down like a bond fund. And most of the stocks in the portfolio gave you a 7, 8 to 10% pay increase. So your income never changed. And by the end of 2009, the stock market was back to where it was. So you recouped your losses. Bonds continued to make gains, pay you that income that was steady and never changed. And your stocks were giving you pay increase every single year. So the problem that we have today that we see so often is this lack of diversification. Investors are all in. They're usually all in bond funds, as many investors are today, or in cash, or a lot of investors just went all out in precious metals. And those investors that ditched their stocks, got out of them, many of them at the bottom, missed out on all the wealth accumulation effects, and especially the outperformance of, let's say, stocks versus bonds by almost a 7-to-1 margin since this economic recovery. And the thing you have to know is nobody, I don't care, those of us here at Financial Sense, your own advisors, politicians, Federal Reserve chairmen, nobody knows for sure where the markets are heading or what dangers or risk lie out there. There's always going to be a crisis. In my own opinion, given financial repression and where interest rates are today, to me, the next major crisis is going to originate in the bond market. When you have German bund yields at 8 basis points or less than 1/10 of a percent, Think of what happens when interest rates go up. Think of what happened to Japanese investors that saw interest rates go from, let's say, less than 0.2% to almost 0.4%. So we know that the Fed is going to embark on raising interest rates. It may take longer than expected, but they're going to start raising them. When that happens, it's going to hurt the value of bonds, which means bond investors are going to lose money. Now, it may not be for a while. It could be next year or the year after. But it is a major risk out there. And I think, personally, John, that's going to be the epicenter of the next crisis.
You know, the other risk dangers we see are, say, for example, healthcare. And you probably need to explain why this is going to be such an impact, especially when it goes into effect, the final stages of Obamacare after the 2016 elections. What, the premiums and the taxes are then going up, and coverage is going to get less and less. Now, you have to explain this, because remember, we were promised all of these things, that we're going to have all this great coverage. What about paying for coverage you don't need? It costs more. So how do investors prepare for that? But that's going to really surprise a lot of people.
Well, I mean, I think the one clear understanding, you need to understand that costs are going to be going up. I mean, our medical premiums have gone up almost 40% since Obamacare was passed. And John, we haven't gotten until 2017 when the full effect of Obamacare goes into effect. That's when, you know, people like myself are going to have to pay for drug abuse therapy, even though I don't need it. We're going to have to pay for pregnancy coverage, even though we don't need that. So I'm going to be forced, everybody, including all members of my staff, are going to be forced to pay for things they don't need. So it's kind of like going into a dealership and buying a car, and all of a sudden they throw in all these options on the car that increase the price of the car. That's what's going to happen to healthcare going forward. So number one, you want to make sure you have coverage, whether you do that through work on your own or through the exchanges. Another way to prepare for this is, if you can, health savings accounts, if you can afford them, that can take care of your health. And more importantly, John, I think that is going to be one of the strongest messages, and one of the reasons why we cover health issues, including today on the program, is you're going to have to learn to take better care of your health. The day where the insurance company and the government picked up everything due to, you know, poor habits or not taking care of yourself, one of the things about Obamacare is it rations health care. And especially if you have a history of health problems, you know, one of the things you can do, especially if you're nearing retirement, if you're in your 50s, this is the time you want to buy long-term care coverage, because it's cheap and it's affordable. You get into your 60s and your 70s, you know, you better have some income growth or some kind of an annuity plan to pay for long-term care, because we'll talk about that in a case study today, where that ended up becoming a major factor in the outcome of one widow's retirement. So plan to pay more, plan to get less, and start focusing on your health.
Okay, we're going to move on to our case study here. But before we do, we want to emphasize that there are changes that are lying ahead that can actually be anticipated. The risks are, number one, there are risks in the financial market. Number two, healthcare risks. We can see this. Three, we know the Fed intends to have rate hikes. Number four, there'll be a raise in taxes and a decrease in government benefits. So you do have some choices available. You may get caught by surprise by a rogue wave and a black swan, but you should have steps in place to prepare for them and navigate these types of situations. Don't get caught totally unaware. Don't fall victim to procrastination. It can be deadly to your financial health, not in some cases, to mention your real health. So anyway, that said, let's discuss this week's case study, because it illustrates the point. As with all of our case studies, the case is real, but the names have been changed to protect the privacy of the individuals involved. And the people we are going to talk about are
Brett and Debbie Wagner. Both Brett and Debbie were a client of ours. Brett was age 53. His wife, Debbie, was 47. Brett was a tech company executive, doing quite well. The problem, and this just came about recently, was Brett's mother. Now, Brett comes from a family, 5 kids, 2 boys, 3 girls. And Brett's dad died at an early age, very little way in pensions for his mother. And Brett helped to supplement his mother's income since his dad's death. The problem is the mother had a stroke. And when she had a stroke, she fell, hit her head. And according to Brett, in the way that she fell or where she hit her head, it did something to damage her brain and accelerate the process of dementia and Alzheimer's. And she went from growing dementia and deteriorating health. The health was gradually ailing because she was getting up in her age. She's 85 years old to now she is in a long-term care facility because as a result of the stroke and the onset of Alzheimer's, which is accelerated as a result of the stroke and the fall, the damage that was done to the brain as a result of hitting her head, basically, she is in a long-term care facility to the tune of over $6,000 a month. So we got two things. We've got a house, and now what do you do with the house? And now we have the added expenses of a health long-term care, which is running $6,000. So Brett is basically trying to liquidate some assets to pay for that. But mainly, Brett is using his savings to take care of mom in the meantime. And this is one of the dangers that you have. And we often talk about this on the program, that the average couple age 65, you will probably spend $250,000 out-of-pocket expenses during your retirement between the two of you. And that's a lot of money. And most people don't factor that in when it comes to retirement planning. Yes, you get that number and that number tells you, you know, if I have X amount of income, I can live this kind of lifestyle. What a lot of people don't plan for is these kind of events. Some kind of medical event happens where one spouse gets sick. And today with Medicare not covering all expenses and even worse under Obamacare, you know, individuals are having to pay for more and more of their own expenses. And they're talking about making individuals pay even more. As the more boomers move into retirement, it's putting strain on the government's budget. And here was an example. There was no long-term care. So the family is picking up the cost. Now, hopefully Brett is going to be able to sell his mother's home and use the proceeds to help defray some of the cost of long-term care. But here was a situation, John, and well, you know this, you took care of your own ailing mother. What was it, 5 years? You had to take care of her and what? You added on and had to have an extra room to take care of your mother because she wasn't capable of taking care of herself.
Right. And the real thing that people don't even anticipate, Jim, and I hear this coming from other people in our age group, that they never realized what it was like giving 24/7 care. It doesn't mean, you know, intensive care, but just ongoing supervision and needs to someone like that with Alzheimer's or another. I talked to a woman who had had her mother for 10 years before her mother passed on. And she said people at her church just never even had a clue of what she was going through and how exhaustive the whole process was.
It's not only just exhaustive, and it's one of the reasons, and especially in the case of Brett's mother, where she had to have constant care. Brett lives here in California, so that doesn't work. And so, you know, his mother who lives in Texas, well, you know, what are you going to do? He can't do it. So he had to fly to Texas, get his mother into a care facility that he approved of because he wanted his mom to have good care. But John, you know, here's $6,000 a month in additional expenses that wasn't in the budget. And who's picking that up right now but Brett and Debbie? Because the other members of the family aren't as well off as Brett is. And so that's what's going to happen here until, you know, they can sell the house and maybe use the proceeds because the value of the house isn't going to be enough. It might be able to take care of his mom for 2 or 3 years if they just simply spend the principal. But in an era of zero interest rates, there's just not enough. You know, the house is maybe worth a couple $100,000. You know, you're not going to get that in today's market. I mean, when you're 2%, at best, in a 10-year treasury, that's $4,000 a year. That doesn't even cover 1 month stay in a long-term care facility. So here was a retirement plan that was going along where Brett was aiding his mother with some additional supplemental income to help her get along. But all of a sudden, here comes along something they did not plan for. And all of a sudden, you're talking about an additional $72,000 a year in living expenses thrown into the budget. I mean, 3 years in that program, you get to that number we talk about of almost $250,000 a year.
Let's look at what could have been done to avoid walking into this issue.
You know, this is a very tough one because Brett lost his father at an early age. You know, the best time to plan for this, obviously, is the younger you are and the earlier that you do it. So, you know, buying long-term care insurance when you are in your 50s is probably the most prudent way to do because at that point, the insurance rates are cheaper. It's no different than buying life insurance when you're a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old. Life insurance is obviously cheaper than when you're a 50 or 60-year-old. So long-term care in your 50s makes a lot of sense. By the time you get into your 60s and 70s, it just gets cost prohibitive. So what you need to do is either have some form of inflationary type assets so that your income is going up each year that you can afford it. Secondly, instead of maybe a long-term care policy, is set up some kind of joint annuity program that can be annuitized if one spouse goes into a long-term care facility. If that never happens and a person dies, let's say of natural death, then that annuity policy can go to the surviving spouse, and that surviving spouse has those annuities, which can be annuitized to pay for long-term care. We're going to do a show on that because there's some special advantages of using annuities to take care of long-term care. So we'll get an expert here on the program and talk about it. The other thing, too, is having a corporate trustee. Because given the health conditions that we have here with Brett was telling me about his mom, you know, sooner or later, she's going to pass on and you're going to have to deal with issues. So you got Brett living in California working for a technology company. Mom's living in Texas. None of the brothers and sisters are even close to mom anymore. Everybody's moved in different directions. Who's going to take care of settling mom's estate and keep the peace in the family? And that's one thing that corporate trustees can do. And that's one way to resolve not only conflicts between, let's say, siblings, but also all the issues that you have to deal with when one spouse passes on or the final estate is taken care of, whether you're filing a 706 return, income tax, gathering the assets, making sure the distributions are made, especially on IRAs and other type assets. So, John, you know, here was a case where everything was going along, and all of a sudden something like this happens, a tragic medical event like a stroke that ended up with a fall with a damage to the brain that accelerated the Alzheimer's process.
And a big issue, I would think, Jim, when you have families like that, where you have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 siblings, is if you don't have this stuff put in place, then you wind up in a lot of squabbling, not just as far as who's inheriting what, but in what's going to happen, rather than having it all set out ahead of time. And by the way, that brings us to our guest today on the program, Dr. Gary Small at the UCA Center for Longevity, coming up next here on Lifetime Income at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
It's no secret, Americans are living longer. With advances in medicine and technology, Americans at one time where the life expectancy was 65 for a male, it's now into the upper 70s and 80s. But with aging comes problems like dementia and Alzheimer's. Joining me on the program is Dr. Gary Small. He's author of a new best-selling book, 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. He is the Parlow Solomon Professor on Aging and a Professor of Psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Doctor, as we begin, can you explain for our listeners the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
I certainly can. I'm glad you asked that because it creates a lot of confusion. I mean, I've had families say, thank God it's not Alzheimer's, it's only dementia. And that only speaks to a misunderstanding of the terms. Dementia means that somebody has a cognitive impairment to the extent that they need help from others. Now, a lot of things can cause dementia. You can have a temporary dementia from medication toxicity, from a thyroid imbalance. But the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. About 70% of late life dementias are from Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is a gradual buildup of abnormal protein deposits in the brain. They're called plaques and tangles. They build up gradually. They cause a gradual decline in memory and other mental abilities. So there's no cure for it. We have some treatments, but we've got to realize that there is definitely a difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Some people could have Alzheimer's disease in their brain, but it's very mild. It's not to the extent that it causes dementia where they need help from others.
Now, I had a client recently that came to our attention. This was a woman who was 85 years old, and she had a stroke. And when she had the stroke, she fell. She hit her head on tile or something and damaged part of her brain. She is now, after almost a month, in hospice. She's been diagnosed with dementia and Alzheimer's. So what you're saying here is maybe the beginning of dementia was Alzheimer's to begin with, but how can you go from a situation where this person, her kids were saying that, you know, she seemed normal last fall, you know, some slip of memory, which we see with people as they get older, some memory things, and sometimes she would get lost driving at night, so they didn't want her driving. But how can you go from, was it the stroke that really brought on or accelerated the Alzheimer's? I mean, how do you go from one situation to the other that rapidly?
I can't really speculate what happened in this individual, not knowing the case. But I can say that it brings up a lot of issues, particularly how people can have several things wrong in their brain. Now, you said she was 85, and at that age, the risk for Alzheimer's is relatively high. Some studies show that almost 50% of people 85 or older have a risk for Alzheimer's. So she may have had a very mild case of Alzheimer's, but then with additional damage to the brain from a stroke, from head trauma, or from both, that just accelerated the cognitive decline. Studies have been done where they look at the brains of large numbers of people with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease prior to death. And at autopsy, they find usually there's more than just Alzheimer's disease in the brain. Very often there are small strokes or there's evidence of head trauma or other problems as well. The bottom line is it's important whether or not somebody has Alzheimer's disease, Alzheimer's dementia, or just the common forgetfulness we all experience as we age, that we do whatever we can to keep our brains healthy and to optimize our memory performance.
Now, Doctor, in your previous books and discussions we've had here on Lifetime Income, you've talked about 75% of Alzheimer's could be attributed to lifestyle, about 25% hereditary measures. And that was sort of a major revelation because a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, grandfather had it, I guess I get it. But you're saying that really a lot of this can be triggered by our lifestyle choices.
Those figures depend on the study you're looking at. I mean, some studies, it might be a 50-50 breakdown. Other studies, it might be one-third, two-thirds, one-third genetics, two-thirds lifestyle. But I think the major point is that modifiable risk factors are much more important than people realize. A recent study concluded that at least half of Alzheimer's cases worldwide could be attributed to modifiable risk factors. Lack of physical exercise, untreated depression, diabetes, hypertension, a lot of things that happen to our bodies that can adversely affect our brains. And the message is that we all have more control than we realize when it comes to protecting our brain health.
You know, we don't think of that. I mean, we all know that if you eat a healthy diet, you know, that reduces the risk of diabetes, reduces the risk of heart disease. We know exercise is good for our bodies. But doctor, are there exercises we can do for our brain? I mean, we think of, you know, Pilates, weightlifting, aerobics, things like that, cardio exercise. But what about brain exercise?
There certainly are exercises, and that's what 2 weeks to a younger brain is about, is devising a program that all of us can follow where we see results in a very brief period of time. And probably the most important exercise you can do for your brain is to exercise your body. There's compelling scientific evidence that if you get regular cardiovascular conditioning, it's not only going to keep your heart healthy, it's going to keep your brain healthy. It gets your heart to pump oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells. Your body produces chemicals that actually get your brain cells to communicate more effectively. And we also recommend strength training as an additional exercise. And then, of course, there's a whole array of mental aerobics and brain fitness exercises that people can do to help keep their neurons limber, and specific training exercises to rapidly improve memory performance.
You know, that's interesting because my mother-in-law lived into her late 80s and her mother was into their 90s and they were both bridge masters. You know, we have people like Warren Buffett, sharp as a tack, and he's in his 80s. Are there things that you can do when you talk about brain exercises? What are you talking about?
Anything that people enjoy that results in a form of mental stimulation is probably good for your brain. Many studies show that if you finish college or you engage in lifelong learning or you read or even have stimulating conversations, that is associated with better brain health. We've studied older people searching online, and we find that just an hour a day of searching online in somebody who's never done it before results in significant activation of important brain circuits. So keeping your brain sharp means finding that sweet spot in doing things that stimulate your mind to keep those neurons firing.
Could it be doing things that are different? Let's say I was an engineer or I'm a financial analyst by training, but I do something like take up a foreign language, you know, ballroom dancing, do something that I'm not used to where I'm causing my brain or my body to do things that are different.
That can be very helpful, and we often recommend taking up new hobbies. Dancing, of course, there's been many studies showing the cognitive benefits of dancing, but there's also a little bit of a caveat with that, and I like the idea of training but not straining your brain. A number of years ago, somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, Dr. Small, you said I should learn a language. I really hated it." And that really wasn't my intent. My intent is to try different things and do things you like. If it's something that's too demanding, it's going to be frustrating. We know that stress is not good for the brain. So you want to find something that is interesting and different that engages your mental circuits. And our brains are really wired that way. We like novelty. It is pleasurable. But if it's too new and too out there, it might be overwhelming.
There are other online programs that we've seen come about, things like Lumosity. Can you talk about that, its purpose, and how effective is something like that?
So Lumosity is very popular. A lot of people enjoy it, and its intent is to try to stimulate different areas of the brain. I call it cross-training the brain, where you know, you have exercises for attention, exercises for language skills, exercises for visual spatial skills. And each of these kinds of exercises will stimulate different parts of the brain. And like many other online games, another one is Bacon Brain Fitness, Cognicity, all kinds of websites and programs that are out there. Not only do they exercise different parts of the brain, but they allow you to gradually build up the exercise. So again, you train and not strain your brain. That's an important principle. There are also specific computer programs, and we have a whole chapter in the book on this, that will really stimulate certain important mental functions. There's a video game that involves keeping a race car on a winding road while there are distracting road signs. And systematic studies have found that that game can actually improve multitasking skills. An 80-year-old who plays the game can start multitasking like an untrained 20-year-old. So there can be specific applications of specific types of games that really have an impact.
Let's talk about a situation that we're seeing. We know right now that we have the largest retirement population in history, the baby boomers heading into retirement. So let's say, doctor, that up until this time, you know, you've been a busy executive or in your career, so you haven't really paid a lot of attention to health issues or stress issues. Now you're heading into retirement. What can be done correctively? We know that you talked about exercise. So I guess maybe diet and exercise and de-stressing would probably be three you'd probably put at the top of your list.
Yeah, those are three major activities to keep in mind, particularly during retirement, because the studies show that retirement is associated with a higher risk of cognitive decline. Now, it could be that people are already declining and that's why they retire, or it could be the lack of engagement in activities that accelerates that process. So getting a regular exercise program, making sure you're spending time with friends and family so you have that social engagement, dealing with stress. Our team here at UCLA has done studies looking at Tai Chi and meditation and yoga and finding that not only does it improve mood, but it improves memory and cognitive function. So you can actually rewire your brain by learning how to manage stress better.
So the things that you can do, we talked about that make a lot of sense, exercise, diet, and de-stressing. What if you are in a situation where you're having some of these problems, or there's a history in your family of Alzheimer's disease? Outside of doing the exercise, getting your diet in order, de-stressing, are there supplements? Are there things that can really, you know, it's kind of like, I guess the word I want to use, put a turbo on your engine?
So I think that, you know, you can take supplements. You know, we're studying them, and, you know, you have to be cautious about some of the claims that are made. Certainly a multivitamin is reasonable. Omega-3 fats, there's been a lot of studies on them and some of the other vitamins. But I think that people shouldn't look for a magic bullet in a pill. And, you know, you mentioned diet, and there are some simple measures that can have a big impact on brain health when it comes to diet. We have an epidemic of obesity and overweight. And if people can manage the number of calories they take in, that can have a big impact. Recent studies have found that obesity can actually quadruple your risk for Alzheimer's disease. But when they take obese people and have them lose weight, they have a pretty rapid improvement in their memory performance. So your brain is resilient. It will respond well if you take care of it.
Now, you hear things like there's certain kind of herbs or anything like that. Do you buy into that? In other words, are there any supplements out there that maybe they're not super foods or anything like that, but do aid in assisting brain function?
Well, there have been studies of some supplements that have shown benefits after, say, several months. You know, an example would be phosphatidylserine and some other supplements. Now, people will take those. It might help them. We're not sure what happens in the long term. There are antioxidant supplements that people take. I like to drive people towards their diet because you can get antioxidants from your diet. Most people don't eat the recommended 5 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables every day. Those are chock full of antioxidants. Omega-3 fats from fish oil supplements, you can get them by eating fish, flaxseed, or walnuts and other nuts. Or another great anti-inflammatory omega fat is omega-9 from olive oil or avocados. So there is a brain-healthy diet that really can have an impact on a person's life. Another aspect of diet is to try to minimize the refined carbohydrates and processed foods. And those can increase a person's risk for type 2 diabetes. And we know that diabetes can double your risk for Alzheimer's. So there are two strategies that we know will prevent diabetes: physical exercise and healthy diet. So if you really engage in this healthy lifestyle to keep your brain young, you're not only going to keep your brain young, you're going to keep your body healthy.
Let's talk about your new book. You've written several. This one is called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. What's different about this book, and what is the impact you're hoping to get? If I read your book, what am I going to walk away with?
You're going to walk away with the knowledge that how you act every day has an impact on your brain health. And this is really step one, that people realize that their daily decisions, whether to take the stairs or take the elevator, whether to have a breakfast of coffee and a donut, or a healthy protein and healthy carbohydrate, whether to take a break from those hours of computer work and meditate a little bit, or to continue on and work on the computer. Once you have that realization, you're much more motivated to do something about it. You're also going to understand the science behind the connection between behavior and brain health. And then finally, you're going to walk away with a very simple program that's laid out in detail, that's straightforward, where you can get started right away. You can begin a 2-week Younger Brain program, and you'll see results. There are assessments at the beginning, middle, and end of those 2 weeks. And for the vast majority of people, they're going to see how their memory is going to improve quite a bit, and they're going to start feeling better.
And, you know, let's say you do have a history of, let's say, Alzheimer's running in the family. What are the chances genetically of reversing that by doing the various things that you're talking about? Let's say that I exercise 5 or 6 days a week, including a good cardio workout. I'm eating a very healthy diet of fresh fruit, vegetables, very organic food instead of, let's say, processed food. You know, I do yoga or meditation or Pilates. each day. Given that I do all those things, what are the chances I can reverse my probability of getting Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I think that we don't yet have a cure for the disease, but the studies suggest that if you engage in a regular healthy brain program, that you can stave off symptoms for years. And it could be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, even more if you stick to the program. Now, there have been studies showing that people, even with a genetic risk for Alzheimer's, if they exercise regularly, they have less of the Alzheimer amyloid plaque in their brain. So the fact that you have a family history or a genetic risk is no reason to give up. If anything, that motivates people more. And they really engage in their program because they've seen the devastating consequences of this disease. And let me add another point. Anybody who is concerned about their memory and they're seeing problems and changes, talk to your doctor. Because in addition to the lifestyle approach, medical recognition and treatment is very important. We don't have a cure for the disease, but there are symptomatic treatments, medical treatments that can make a difference. And we found in our own practice that combining the younger brain lifestyle with a conventional medical approach seems to have an even better effect than either alone.
Doctor, a lot of the things that you have pointed out, which can aid and assist in strengthening our brains, we've seen tremendous advances made in medicine. I can think of what we're doing with heart disease now, where we know the role of diet and exercise, good foods, you know, from bypass surgery to stents to some of the drugs that are out there. What has been the progress of, let's say, medical technology in resolving or, let's say, coming up for a cure of Alzheimer's?
There's a lot of interesting things going on. And in the book, we certainly bring people up to date on some of the latest breakthroughs. But we've got new technologies where we can look at brain scans and identify problems years before people have symptoms. And that's important because that allows us to test novel treatments before there's extensive damage. I mean, our whole approach, whether it's lifestyle or medication or supplements, it's to try to protect a healthy brain rather than try to repair damage once it's extensive. We think the former is a much more feasible strategy than the latter. And there are some interesting drugs that are being tested. There's been a lot of work trying to stop the buildup of the amyloid plaques in the brain. Unfortunately, it hasn't been as successful as we'd like. There's some new research that's coming out showing the importance of the tau protein, and that'll probably lead to more efforts there. We've been intrigued by the fact that inflammation in the brain seems to be so important. If you look at an Alzheimer brain, you see evidence of inflammation, which of course is a natural physiological process. It helps our body repair damaged tissue or fight off infection if there's a problem. But what happens as our brains age, we get too much inflammation, and those inflammatory cells are attacking healthy cells. So in fact, the healthy brain strategies, physical exercise, consuming omega-3 fats, or getting a good night's sleep, those are all anti-inflammatory strategies. So I think it's an exciting time in terms of the research. I'm confident that in the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to see some breakthroughs. But while we're waiting for science to catch up, there's a tremendous amount we all can do.
So, Doctor, if you were to give a message to our listeners out there that are concerned about this, either through a history in the family or they're dealing, as my client is now, with a mother who had this tragic stroke and fall and is now in hospice, what would the steps or the things you would recommend at the top of your list? Let's say if you were to say 3 things you should do right now to keep your brain healthy, what would they be?
I would say that you need to get active every day. Create an exercise habit. 15 minutes of brisk walking each day is associated with a lower risk for Alzheimer's disease. Stay socially connected and keep your mind stimulated. Enjoy your life with your friends and your family. And the third thing is eat a healthy diet. Protect your brain from oxidative stress, from inflammation, by consuming the right amounts of foods, not overeating, and enjoy yourself while you're at it. Positive outlook is also associated with a healthier brain and longer life expectancy.
And may I make another recommendation to our listeners? Your new book, 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain.
Thank you.
There's some great stuff in there. Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us once again on Lifetime Income. Keep up the good work and the study that you're doing at the UCLA Longevity Center, because we're just making great strides, and this is one area I hope to see in the next 5 or 6 years a great breakthrough. Doctor, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. And, you know, as we talked about in the first part of the program about, unfortunately, what happened to that widow, and as we talked about being prepared, you have to take and treat your automobile with maintenance. You know, you change the oil. The same thing with your health. It's amazing when it comes to our finances how little we spend time in making sure that we not only take our finances and put them in order, but even more importantly, keeping our health in order. And I hope you do many of the things that we just talked about in this interview, because a lot of this is lifestyle related. And the good news, it can be corrected. So on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, as always, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.